You know, this disease is due to, it's a neurohormonal disease. No, it's not a nutritional disease. It's neurohormonal. And what do I mean by that? It involves pathophysiological processes involving satiety hormones and the way they interact with feeding centers in the brain. And they're offset to generate and sustain a higher level of adiposity. That's just part of the disease. When patients lose weight, those mechanisms kick in overdrive and work doubly hard to return that weight back up to the previous high level. So that's what patients have to fight against. It's not easy, and it's not their fault. It's just not the patient's fault. And this is why we need medications in order to kind of reset these pathways to maintain a lower level of body weight and suppress appetite.
Welcome to the GLP-1 Podcast Show, a monthly podcast where you'll find cutting-edge insights and all that's working in the world of metabolic health and obesity care. Our aspiration is to be the first place you are going to go to find out what's happening, the latest updates, and the latest research in GLP-1 science and clinical practice.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Stop hiring for problems automation can solve. Start with Elevate Agents. Don't hire another VA stuck in 2015. Hire a remote AI specialist from Latin who runs AI tools, works in your time zone, and helps your team move faster. Schedule your free strategy call at www.wisevas.io. Zentrix OS, the business operating system built for teams who are serious about goals, tasks, and measurable results. One platform to run your entire operation. Zentrix Insights, the right person in the right seat starts with knowing how your team is actually wired. Visit ZentrixInsights.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the GLP-1 Podcast Show. I'm your host, Arisha. And today we're joined by Dr. Timothy Garvey, an endocrinologist and endowed professor of medicine at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He is one of the world's leading experts in obesity, insulin resistance, and type 2 diabetes. And he's also someone who has helped establish the concept of adiposity-based chronic disease, or ABCD, which is what we'll be delving into a little bit today. So thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Garvey.
Arisha, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here to speak to your audience about a subject that I care a lot about, actually. So thank you.
Perfect. So from my understanding, ABCD, it's a new terminology that kind of provides a framework for understanding obesity more as a chronic disease that's not simply driven by body weight, but by excess or dysfunctional adiposity and its health consequences. So I guess to begin, can you kind of explain this in your own terms and why this distinction matters compared to how we previously viewed obesity?
Yes, thank you for that question. You know, We really treat, when you treat obesity as a chronic disease, we treat it to improve the health of the patient, right? And what makes the patient unhealthy? What impairs their quality of life? It's the complications of the disease, you know, whether it's diabetes or sleep apnea or osteoarthritis or other complications of the disease. So our goal is not just to lose X amount of weight, it's to lose sufficient weight to improve or prevent the complications of the disease and improve quality of life and health in that way. When you use the term obesity, and I realize that's widely used, of course, in society, it just conjures up BMI, okay? It's just like weight. And plus in social media, it's fraught with a lot of stigmatization and bias. And, you know, when we use the term adiposity-based chronic disease, it's more medically actionable, okay? It tells you what we're treating, which is abnormalities in the mass, distribution, or function of adipose tissue, and why we treat it, like I alluded to. It's a chronic disease, it's lifelong, and it has complications that impair health. So it just kind of engenders a more complication-centric approach to care as opposed to just focusing on BMI only.
And why do you feel there was a need for this new terminology?
Well, you know, I started becoming more passionate about obesity when we had our first generation medications approved back in the early, 2010s, 2014. You know, our I use the generic names, our phentermine topiramates, our bupropion naltrexone, our liraglutides. You know, these medicines could achieve on average, probably less than 10% weight loss, but this was still a valuable amount of weight loss and could improve the health of our patients. And at that point, nobody thought obesity was a disease, and there was even less insurance coverage than there is now. And large employers didn't understand obesity. BMI, it doesn't tell you the impact on health. It just tells you, height and weight, really. Index of height and weight. So, that's why we thought we'd bring it more into the medical realm as a diagnostic term. That's probably not for general use in lay public. But, when doctors use a term like adiposity-based chronic disease, what are they going to be thinking about? They're going to be thinking about treating this as a disease. And, let me just say one thing about how the advances we've made. And this is important for patients in particular and doctors, too. This disease is it's a neurohormonal disease. Now, it's not a nutritional disease. It's neurohormonal. And what do I mean by that? It involves pathophysiological processes involving satiety hormones and the way they interact with feeding centers in the brain. And they're offset to generate and sustain a higher level of adiposity. That's just part of the disease. When patients lose weight, those mechanisms kick in overdrive and work doubly hard to return that weight back up to the previous high level. So that's what patients have to fight against. It's not easy, and it's not their fault. It's just not the patient's fault. And this is why we need medications in order to kind of reset these pathways to maintain a lower level of body weight and suppress appetite.
Amazing. And do you think this framework changes how clinicians should think about obesity, or also like patients and the general population at large?
Yes. Well, I was the lead author on these obesity guidelines in 2016, published by the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology. And these guidelines were the first to call it explicitly for a complication-centric approach to care. And now guidelines all across the world feature this. They're all harmonized around this. And so that's the guidelines. And I think the progress has been made. It's changing the way we think about obesity culturally. These things take time, but this is what's in the books, and it's making a difference. What's working against us, though, is the popularity of these medications, and I understand that. But when patients can get these medications online without an evaluation by a healthcare professional, or they get compounded medications that we don't know what's in those compounded medications, the concentrations, the excipients, or what else is in there besides the medication. There's potential harm, and the FDA has warned against this. So, I think that's working against us because in terms of really treating this as a disease and not just kind of a let's lose weight and more as a cosmetic enterprise. Although, I understand that perspective as well. And, I don't blame people. I'm kind of rambling here, but let me add, people struggle with this disease. I mean, it impairs their quality of life, and they suffer this with this, and they've tried many years out of their life to kind of deal with it, and it's been difficult, and they see the potential of these new medicines, and they just want to get their hands on them. And then they try to make an appointment with their healthcare professional, 6 months from now, and then the medications are really expensive, and I don't blame patients for seeking out these medications, but it's not optimal. We don't treat any other chronic disease that way. And I just want what's best for patients, and our patients deserve the best. And so I am an advocate for complication-centric care and management of adiposity-based chronic disease by healthcare professionals.
I completely agree with you. And I also think social media has played a huge role in sort of pushing this cosmetic narrative and focusing a lot of the attention of these newer drugs on the aesthetic side of things and the body, the loss of weight loss, and kind of pushing aside the health benefits that patients who are struggling are receiving with these drugs. So I really, really appreciate the new terminology and the push, the advocacy for the complications of obesity as well.
Most teams don't have a strategy problem. They have a systems problem. Tasks scattered across tools, goals buried in spreadsheets, and metrics no one actually checks. Zentrix OS fixes that. It's a true business operating system that brings tasks, goals, and performance metrics into one connected workspace. So your team always knows what to do, why it matters, and how they're tracking. No more juggling apps. No more missed accountability. Just a clear, organized way to run your business the way it was meant to be run. If you're ready to stop managing chaos and start managing with clarity, Zentrix OS is built for you. Visit ZentrixOS.com and take control of how your team operates.
Okay, so you mentioned complication-centric care. So what kinds of obesity-related complications should clinicians look out for or assess routinely?
Well, let me put it this way. You know, even phase three clinical trials have adopted a complication-centric approach, where some of these trials, is weight loss is not the primary outcome measure. It's the improvement in a specific complication that becomes the primary outcome measure. So semaglutide, for example, has been shown in phase three clinical trials to be effective in cardioprotection, secondary cardioprotection. So if you have a patient with obesity that's had a heart attack or a stroke or a acute coronary syndrome, we know then that putting patients on semaglutide can reduce the hazard ratio for another cardiovascular disease event by 20%. And that's in patients that are already on statins and other risk-lowering medications and lipid-lowering medications. Another example is tirzepatide in patients with obstructive sleep apnea. That was shown to be effective in a phase three clinical trial, and now a tirzepatide has an FDA indication, the only medication approved to treat obstructive sleep apnea. MASH, you know, metabolic associated steatohepatitis, metabolic dysfunction associated to steatohepatitis, there's a phase three trial showing semaglutide improves it histologically. And that's now has an FDA indication to treat MASH. And these medications have been shown to improve congestive heart failure, a particular kind of congestive heart failure called heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, which is part of the cardiometabolic disease nexus. These medications have been shown to prevent progression to diabetes. And in patients with type 2 diabetes who have obesity as well, semaglutide and tirzepatide can the vast majority of patients achieve hemoglobin A1C targets, even normal hemoglobin A1C is at 5.7% or less. And the amazing news is with minimal or no hypoglycemia. Arisha, you know, I've been around a little while, and I remember as an intern and resident, we treating diabetes, we had, you know, NPH and regular insulin and sulfonylureas, and then metformin came along and we're so happy. But to think we could control this diabetes to a normal hemoglobin A1C without hypoglycemia, I just never thought I'd see those days. And now we're seeing this in clinical trials and in the clinic when we use these second generation medications for obesity. So you get the idea. And so anything that weight loss will improve, you know, whether it's blood pressure or lipids or osteoarthritis or and all of these and other indications that I mentioned are fair game. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes patients feel better and live a longer, healthier life.
Amazing. And once you've identified these obesity related complications, do they factor into your treatment strategy?
They do. You know, I've been involved with professional societies. I'll just mention I mentioned the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, and the American Diabetes Association now is publishing a standards of care for treating obesity, like they do with diabetes. And the European Association for the Study of Obesity has also come out with some advice along these lines. In these guidelines, there's figures that show hierarchies of preferred medications based on the specific complications that the patient in front of you may have. So all these medications that have received FDA indications or have been shown in phase 3 clinical trials to effectively treat that complication, we have that evidence base. And so these guidelines call, you know, take advantage of that and recommend these specific medications, whether it's to semaglutide or tirzepatide or phentermine topiramate, which is shown to be effective too in diabetes prevention and sleep apnea, to use these medications in patients that have those complications specifically, because we know we have the evidence, we can help them out. So I do advocate that kind of complication-centric use of preferred medications.
I'm sure the flow diagram will be very helpful for clinicians all over who are still kind of new to this area and trying to figure out which medication would be optimal for their patients. Just off the top of your head, are there certain complications which would make you favor one medication over another?
You know, these medications, these second-generation medications are GLP-1-based, okay? They agonize the GLP-1 receptor in the hypothalamus, where it suppresses appetite, but also in other parts of the brain, like the area postrema, that cause nausea. So in about 40-45% of patients that take these medications, they're going to have nausea and other GI symptoms, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation. Usually it's manageable. Usually it's worse during the early phases where we're escalating the dose up to the treatment dose. But you know, I've been wondering, asking myself, why should our patients have to be sick to their stomach for the privilege of having their disease treated? So you know, I think if one of these medications is causing GI symptoms, the other one may not. There's a big variation in the weight loss response to any of these medications. So patients may lose a lot of weight with one and not with the other, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we need multiple medications out there available so we can individualize care. And this is where I look towards future medication development as well. Medications that are better tolerated and still give us a moderate degree of weight loss that we know we can help our patients with. And I'll just mention one mechanism of action, and that's long-acting amylins. Amylins are a natural protein that's secreted from the pancreas. It's nutrient-regulated. But it also goes to the hypothalamus to suppress appetite and binds different cells than the GLP-1 agonist. And it is much better tolerated from a gastrointestinal symptom perspective, and still gives us like 10 to 20% weight loss, you know, 12-13% weight loss on average. Some lose more, some lose less, but that's enough weight loss to really help our patients a great deal from a complication-centric perspective. And if it's better tolerated, you know, I think great. And I think primary care will have an easier time using drugs that are better tolerated by patients. And so I'm looking forward to those kind of reaching the market and being approved. So we'll see how that goes. And these can be combined with GLP-1s too. In fact, I can see an algorithm developing, you know, begin with a medication like a long-acting amylin and see if you reach your targets, your health targets and your weight loss targets, better tolerated. If you do, fine. If you need more weight loss, then add a GLP-1 on top of that. Like we do with diabetes, one medicine stops working, we add another. I think as we get more medicines approved for obesity, I think we'll have the same kind of paradigm.
There is currently a GLP-1 amylin medication that's currently under phase 3 development, I believe, CagriSema. I didn't realize it was because of the tolerability, actually.
Well, the CagriSema, yes, I was involved in those clinical trials. very potent medication, very effective with weight loss. It's a combination of semaglutide, the GLP-1 receptor agonist, and cagrilintide, which is a long-acting amylin. So CagriSema, it's the combination. You still have the semaglutide in there, the GLP-1, so you're going to have nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation. The addition of the amylin to this semaglutide doesn't cause much of an increase in symptoms. It's the semaglutide underneath that's causing the symptoms. So it's about as well tolerated as the semaglutide alone, but it's more effective.
Okay.
Because there are different pathways, the GLP-1 and the amylin, and they're additive. So you get more weight loss than either one alone. Many patients do fine on submaximal doses. You know, you get to where you need to go on submaximal doses. Some patients respond very well to lower doses. So, again, we have to actively manage weight loss in these patients when we use powerful drugs like this and find the right dose that helps us achieve what the patient wants out of care and what the healthcare professional wants out of care, and harmonize consensus treatment goals, if you will.
Because the main reason I was asking is because we're seeing a lot of variability in the weight loss effects. So there are single GLP-1 agonists, double, triple. There's oral agents that are being developed. There's longer dosing schedules, right? So how would you say, how much does the expected weight loss versus the disease-specific evidence, like you were saying in sleep apnea, in fatty liver disease, how does that factor into your treatment selection?
Well, this is a good, you're raising a point here. Let's start with the amylin that I was talking about. We don't have a lot of that phase 3 clinical trial data showing it specifically improves certain complications. Mm-hmm. We know it produces enough weight loss when we know that just generically weight loss, a certain amount of weight loss will help some of these complications. All of these things I mentioned, most patients don't have these. Most patients with obesity have not had a heart attack. Most patients haven't had congestive heart failure. Most patients don't even have diabetes that have obesity. And most patients don't have MASH. So, you know, these patients that don't have these complications are very well suited to a medication like amylin because those indications aren't there. Mm-hmm. If they do have these complications, then I'd say go for the GLP-1 that's been shown to be effective. But that's not the majority of patients. So yes, it makes a difference what complications they have. And the biggest unmet clinical need right now, Arisha, is patients staying on these medications long-term. And, you know, I mentioned this is a lifelong disease, and I mentioned these pathophysiological pathways that drive weight regain. The medications dampen it while you're taking the medications, but then you stop taking the medications and they're still there. They're still there ready to get to work and they drive weight regain. And, you know, patients get fooled into thinking while they're on the medication, I can handle this disease now. I know how to control my diet and do my exercise. I have much more confidence and control of eating and the way I think about food and food noise. I mean, I've got it all down now. But then it's a little bit of a false sense of security in a way because they go off the medicine and they lose some of those skills that they learned. And you know, it's not their fault. I guess I said, it's a disease process. And when you regain the weight, you lose the health benefits of that weight loss. So we need to find ways to get patients to stay on these medicines for a longer period of time. And you mentioned medications that are given less frequently, once a month, once every 3 months, once every 4 months. And then the oral medications. For those patients who prefer orals rather than weekly injections, maybe that will help them better adhere to the medication. I think there's probably a population of patients like that. And then the less frequent medications, maybe that'll be easier and patients will have more greater persistence on the medications with those. You know, we'll just have to, and one thing's not going to work for everybody. So I'm really glad that pharma is kind of pursuing these different avenues like that with these medications in development?
So the best case scenario would be that the patients stay on these medications indefinitely. But do you have any strategies that might help patients successfully maintain the weight loss if that was not feasible in their case for whatever reason?
Well, every patient's different. You know, I mean, if the medication's working and they've lost their 15% weight loss, for example, and they're off their blood pressure medicines, they're feeling better, they're sleeping better, they have more energy, their knees feel better, they're able to walk and enjoy life better, stay on the medication, you know. But I, as I said, patients develop a false confidence. This is a common scenario. Dr. Garvey, I've lost my weight loss and I feel better and I'm off my medications. I've decreased and boy, I've learned a lot about this disease. But you know, my list leveled off. I'm not losing any more weight, and that's to be expected, of course. And I don't want to keep paying for the medication now. So because I got it now. So, and I'll say, well, this is might very well what's going to happen. You might regain the weight, and they'll say, no. So one thing I'll do is I'll contract with them. I'll say, okay, go home, you know, check your weight. If it comes over a certain level, then you got to come back in and we'll restart the medications, things like that. I try. And then we can try lower doses of medication. You know, patients are out there microdosing. And I don't advocate patients doing that without the supervision of a healthcare professional. But and I think often it doesn't work. But I think sometimes it does work. Patients are able to kind of, if they get like a multi-dose pen or a vial, they kind of experiment with doses they need and a frequency of administration that they kind of experiment with. And some patients find a way to maintain that weight loss. I'd like to know better what they're doing. I'd like to have those patients teach us, give us some advice on how this can work in some patients, you know. I don't know what cues they're using. Are they moderating their dose according to hunger, or weight gain, or side effects, or cost? You know, I'd like to know more about. I think we need to study this.
Yeah.
And some patients teach us. Because right now, the population data show us that after 1 year, 50% of these patients prescribed these second generation GLP-1s aren't taking them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that perspective, we treat the disease just very poorly, despite the advent of these really transformational medications.
I agree with you. I think we should survey these patients and see what's happening behind the scenes that's allowing them. And then we could propagate that forward to all the other patients who are struggling.
I'm talking to a lot of my trainees and fellows here and trying to get, it's a research project, you know, waiting to happen. I think it'd be a valuable project. So I want to supervise the research. I don't want to do the research. So I'm trying to find the right person to do this or trying to encourage them to do that.
I think a lot of people are very focused on the quantitative side of things. So how much weight loss or how much this, instead of the qualitative, is what we need to get into, the nitty gritty, like what's really happening in patients'
yeah.
experiences, you know?
Yeah.
So do you have is there an expected timeline of when the weight, sort of reverts back to baseline for most patients, or is it very individualized?
Oh, after they stop taking the medicine? Yeah, they usually, there's pretty rapid, over the first 3 months, there's pretty rapid weight regain. I mean, patients just start, some patients say they're hungrier than they were before they started the medicine, because their body really wants to return back up to that higher body weight. And so their hunger is really driven. Then that things kind of quiet down a little bit. And if you look at the data, the weight increases and then kind of levels off. And to me, it levels off a little bit below what the baseline weight was at the beginning. So maybe there's a longer term effect. I don't know. But within 6 months to a year, most patients have regained, you know, 50 to 70% of their weight. Not everybody. And some patients can use diet and exercise to keep their weight down. But that's the minority of patients.
Every person on your team is wired differently. Some thrive with structure. Others drive results through autonomy. Some process information fast and move on. Others need depth before they decide. And when the wrong person is in the wrong seat, not because of skill, but because of how someone is built, performance suffers and no one knows why. Zentrix Insights maps exactly that. Behavioral patterns, cognitive style, and natural work preferences are all visible in 15 minutes. So you stop guessing who should own what and start putting the right people in the right seats. Because the best teams are not just talented, they are well-placed. Visit ZentrixInsights.com.
Perfect. Okay, so my final question for you is that, so you mentioned earlier that some patients with obesity are otherwise healthy patients, correct? They don't have type 2 diabetes, they don't have other metabolic disease, they just have obesity. And in this case, these patients really benefit from amylin receptor agonists. So I was kind of thinking, let's say someone is taking a GLP-1 who has obesity and type 2 diabetes, and it's helping both with the weight loss and the glycemic control. And then the glycemic, and then because of the weight loss, there's no more need for these medications in terms of controlling their blood sugar. At what point do you take away other medications they might be taking for diabetes management? And how does this kind of play into your treatment goal?
Yes. Well, of course, this has to be individualized as well. But the patients are usually on metformin and then other things. When I start a second generation GLP-1 medication like semaglutide or tirzepatide in a patient that has both obesity and diabetes, I will usually if they're on sulfonylureas, I'll just take them off. Mm-hmm. And if their hemoglobin A1C is 8% or below, and they're on insulin, I'll usually cut that in half. If it's above that, I might keep them on the insulin that they're on and follow them. But they will start losing weight. We'll just have to follow them. And if their blood sugar starts trending down, you need to kind of decrease their medications and anticipating that. Metformin is a pretty safe drug, although it may not be so effective in these patients in the long run. But, it gets down to, they're down to target hemoglobin A1C, below 6.5%, and they're on metformin, you might just consider a withdrawal of a challenge of metformin and see how they do. Again, you have to individualize this, but many patients can come off medications, still need to be followed. We know diabetes is a progressive disease as well, and there's progressive decline in endogenous insulin secretion, so that's not saying they might not need medicines in the future, so they have to be followed. But it's just amazing how you can take a lot of patients off their medicines or at least decrease their medications profoundly with this level of weight loss and treatment with these second-generation GLP-1 drugs.
I had a similar question about, let's say, antihypertensive, for example. Patients are taking blood pressure medications, and they start taking a GLP-1. The blood pressure goes down. Can we withdraw at some point, or is it, again, it's very patient-specific, individualized care?
Some patients, although I find, it's not uncommon to you're able to decrease doses. Or if they're like on an ACE or an ARB plus a diuretic, maybe you can maybe get them off the diuretic. But I think most patients need to be on some level of antihypertensive therapy, even though they've been on these medications. Decreased dose, yes, but I think many of them need to stay on the medications if it's play it by ear. If mm-hmm. the blood pressure looks good, they should have home blood pressure cuffs. Monitor that. But I find many patients do need to be on some reduced dose of antihypertensives, particularly African-American patients. Mm-hmm. And with the diabetes that we just talked about, it's really nice to have some CGM available for patients, even if they have type 2 diabetes. There's recommendations now that when you're in a really life-changing situation where doses are being changed and CGM is appropriate even in type 2 diabetes. So that's a perfect application of CGM in type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But the expectation is always to stay on the GLP-1, even if we're up titrating, reducing these other medications.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Okay, so we'll end it off here. Thank you so much, Dr. Garvey, for joining us today. I believe your work has really changed the way we understand disease, but also the way that we treat patients. And I really appreciate the patient-centered framework that you have that really brings them to the forefront. So thank you for sharing your insights on complication-centric care and the evolving role of second-generation obesity medications. And thank you so much for the listeners of the GLP-1 podcast show for tuning in. I hope to see you guys at the next episode. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.